Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the court. We have one case today, United States v. Harbarth. And because of the number and complexity of the issues, the court has granted each side 30 minutes to argue. Also, because this case primarily consists of certified issues from the Judge Advocate General, the government will argue first. So, Major Finnan, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the government?
Yes.
And Lieutenant Bilter, are you prepared to argue on behalf of the appellant cross-appellee?
I am.
Very well, then. Please proceed.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, and may it please the court. I am Major Mary Claire Finnan, and I, along with Colonel Ian Pedden, represent the United States. I respectfully request to reserve 3 minutes, Your Honor.
Granted.
Thank you. This court should affirm the findings and sentence for 3 reasons. First, appellant waived the issue of delay between the search and the seizure. The seizure and the search authorization. Second, appellant's wife was not a government agent, and separately, she at the very least gave apparent consent. Third, there is no deterrence value in suppression here, and the costs outweigh the benefits to the justice system. To talk about the first issue, or the waiver, trial defense counsel waived the issue of how long between the search and the seizure. MRE 311 says that objections not made before pleas are waived. Here, the argument was that there was no probable cause at the time of seizure. The reasonableness of the delay for the search warrant was not raised until the lower court. This court's standard has been enunciated in Perkins and Robinson. And in Perkins, the appellant in that case at trial raised the issue that the warrant was lacking in probable cause, was unconstitutionally vague, and failed to meet the particularity requirement.
So, counsel, in regard to this issue of waiver and so forth, turnabout is fair play. So now let's focus, if we may, on certified issue number 2. And assume for a moment that this court agrees with the CCA that the seizure of the iPad 4 and the iPhone 6S violated the Fourth Amendment. Now, you are seeking to argue in your brief about the applicability of the exclusionary rule, but the government didn't raise that issue at trial. The government didn't raise it in its initial brief before this court. And the TJAG did not explicitly raise that issue in terms of a certified issue. So from your perspective, then, should this court view that as a waiver, a forfeiture, a fully preserved argument? How do you think this court should analyze that issue?
I think the appellee raised that issue in their response to the government's filing. That was the first time it was raised at this court. It was not a certified issue. But keep in mind the general principle that this court reviews judgments. It doesn't review opinions. If this court finds other grounds to uphold the lower court's opinion, findings and sentence below, this court may do that. And I think should do that in this
case. But going to my question, is it waived? Is it forfeited? Was it completely, fully preserved by the government? Where do we stand with the applicability of the exclusionary rule?
I don't have a case that would talk about in relation to certified issues. I think at the lower court, this issue was brought up, and there are facts.
But it was the CCA that addressed it. And then you did not raise it in the initial brief before this court.
Yes, Your Honor, but I would just go back to the appellee raised it. We addressed it in the...
So is it forfeited then?
Forfeited.
Plain error review.
Yes, Your Honor. But going back to the waiver issue here, which... Here, like Perkins, the argument here was there was no probable cause. The reasonableness of the delay for the search warrant was not raised, and what the appellee down below argued was unrelated to the issues that are now here before this court. So for the iPhone 10, which was seized on May 11th, the first seizure, the appellee objected to the search while it was in his hands. They said the search infringed on the appellee's reasonable interest in privacy. But they conceded explicitly the seizure, and that's on Joint Appendix 1314. For the iPhone 6 and the iPad that were accepted on May 13th and May 15th, the trial defense counsel objected, very broad objection in the motion to suppress all the evidence of unconstitutional seizures of the accused iPhones and iPads and all data and information contained within the devices. But at the motions hearing, they specifically disclaimed and redirected the agent's testimony regarding the day to specifically focus on the day of the seizure. At Joint Appendix 379, they said, hey, there was no probable cause to seize. When they seized it, at the moment of the seizure, is when we have to judge the potential illegality, and we have to judge what did the law enforcement officer know at that moment. At the moment the seizure occurs, again, this is quotes, both on May 11th and May 15th, they don't have any articulable facts sufficient to demonstrate a reasonable belief that there is evidence of this crime and that they are investigating this in particular. And it's what the officer did at the moment the seizure occurs. So, and then they make some other arguments about the inapplicability of the inevitable discovery doctrine, the lack of NCIS jurisdiction, and that had no actual or apparent authority to consent. So there's also no case law included in their motion or in their argument on the motions hearing that would clue the government in that this was a timing issue for the eventual search authorization. And finally, these are different issues in the law. The Asinor case from the D.C. Circuit makes that clear. There were two cite from that is two lines of cases that can be reconciled. One showing that the government takes possession of an object at a single point in time, but the other cases show that once the government has taken possession, its conduct must remain reasonable. That Asinor case is from just this summer, so that was much later than when this issue was argued. So it's showing that there were still, at the time this was argued, there were two very different issues.
Counsel, I understand your argument with regards to waiver, but also, too, case law is consistent that when constitutional rights are at issue, there's a presumption against waiver. So what is the government's position with regards to that? If we align ourselves with the CCA that there was no waiver, what is the government's position about our presumption against waiver?
I think under this court's precedence in Perkins, that was a constitutional issue as well, Your Honor. And the plain language of MRE 311 saying that if it's not raised, it's waived. And then further down in that same rule, requiring particularity, that it be raised with specificity. Barring any other further questions.
May I ask a question about the waiver? If we were to disagree and find that there was no waiver of the unreasonable delay issue, wouldn't we still have to have a factual hearing to determine whether there were facts which made the delay reasonable or not reasonable?
Yes, Your Honor.
Does the government have a proffer of why it wasn't unreasonable?
No, Your Honor, we don't have a proffer of why it was reasonable. The case activity report was included at the motions hearing, but some facts were later developed on the record in the affidavit, for instance, about what other investigatory steps were taken. But there was nothing talking about, like, for instance, in Stabile, the Secret Service agent got pulled away from the case for 3 months. Well, he got pulled away because he was doing a protective detail. There's nothing that in our record, and we don't have a proffer about what else the NCIS agent was doing that might have taken her away from developing, moving quickly on this seizure authorization. Search authorization.
Oh, go ahead. Oh. So in light of that, then, would it be the government's recommendation that issue be remanded for factual finding of the
Yes. Day? Yes, Your Honor. If this court disregards what the government alleges is waiver, Yes, that would be our alternative relief we would seek. Moving on to whether we have consent or at least apparent consent. I'll first move on to the government did have probable cause here for these devices. MRE 316 allows the government to agents to seize an item with probable cause, but the military judge here should have gone further than just stopping at probable cause, and that's United States versus Place. Nieto, in this case, two things about Nieto. One, it criticized the general assumptions that talked about sort of what humans normally do with their devices. That wasn't the probable cause here. The probable cause was the links between all these devices.
Now, when you say the link between all these devices, you agree that what we have to look at is what the law enforcement officers knew at that time.
Yes, Your Honor.
Not what the military judge later provides as a explanation for his rationale. Didn't the agents here agree with the assertion by trial defense counsel that all they really had was this was Harborth's device? We've already looked at his iPhone XS. We saw that through the plain view doctrine. We saw these images. Therefore, when it comes to the iPad 4 and the iPhone 6S, must be there too. What was the nexus that the law enforcement officers could point to at the time of the seizure with the iPad 4 and the iPhone 6S that granted them the right to seize those items?
In United States versus Wicks in 2013, this case taught, it's sort of an aside or a throwaway, but cell phones are so valuable because they, part of the reason they're so invasive of privacy is that they link to home security systems. And that's what we had here. We had the agents, they say they didn't have probable cause, but it's an objective determination looked at later. So the military judge can look at this and say these are all
devices. So you're saying the agents said they did not have probable cause.
The first agent responding on May 11th tries to give the other devices over then, and he doesn't take them. He doesn't think he has probable cause for them.
Right. And you're going back to what the military judge said. I'm saying, consistent with what the agent said on the scene, what could they point to that indicated that they knew they had the right to seize those specific electronic devices?
They had lived in the home for 3 years, and throughout that time, the daughter and the mother had been told by the accused that his phone got alerts from the security system when the daughter unplugged the camera from the wall.
But wasn't that the iPhone XS?
So it's unclear. I mean, the agents don't know at the time how long he's had each phone. But these phones are in Hawaii with him, in the house. They're apparently readily accessible to him because she can go and get them, you know, the same day she reports the crime. There's a couple officers around. They're talking to her. They're talking to her daughter. There's presumably a lot going on at the time, and she's able to easily access these devices and bring them to the officers.
Does that logic work for the iPads, too?
Yes, Your Honor.
So, I mean, it sounds like the government's argument is that any device that connects to the Internet, there would have been probable cause to be seized.
I think it wouldn't be that broad, Your Honor. These were all Apple devices. I think in Nieto, there was also sort of an acknowledgement that technology changes. So you had Clayton before Nieto. That was, you know, people take pictures and they upload them to other devices. And then in Nieto, the acknowledgement that most people, if they record something...
So are we basically relying on the existence of iCloud then? So do we need a different rule for Apple devices, from Android devices, from some other device? I mean, is our rule, do we have a legal rule that says any Apple device that connects to iCloud is therefore there's probable cause for that device to be seized and searched? If the accused has one device that might have contraband on it?
I think you could cabin it in this, the rule specific to this case, Your Honor, because they've lived in the home. These devices are in the home. They're Apple devices, and they've been there for 3 years.
Counsel, how is that going to differ from virtually any home in this country? You're acting as if, okay, it's had access to the phone. If a neighborhood friend of the stepdaughter came in virtually every day of the week into the home, you'd be arguing that she has access to those phones too. What difference does it make that the electronic devices are in the home and that somebody has access to the physical iPad or iPhone? How does that play into probable cause?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. The probable cause here would be that they knew this, the crime happened over a span of years. I mean, they have reason to believe that because the stepfather has been telling the daughter and the mother that the daughter has to keep the camera plugged in or else he will get those on his alerts on his iPhone.
And you don't know which iPhone?
You don't know which iPhone.
And you have the law enforcement officer saying he didn't believe he had probable cause.
Yes, Your Honor.
And during the testimony, he agrees with the assertion that all he knew was this was Harborth's phone, so maybe there could be connection. And in the government's view, that provides probable cause to every electronic device within that home.
The Apple devices?
All the Apple devices in the home. And so that would be true in any service member's home. With no further showing.
I think under the facts of this case, I don't think it would be that broad, sir. You have a crime that goes back, and there's a specific connection to the crime, that they know, the phone is connected.
If we had one phone, counsel, I could understand your point. Mm-hmm. But we've got three different devices. We've got the one phone, the XS, that's not the issue. The issue is with the iPhone 6S and the iPad 4. And we're looking for this nexus that was in the minds of law enforcement. And I'm not hearing that from you. I just am hearing this broad concept of, well, the crime has been going on for a long time, and it's in the phone, in the home, and it's an Apple device. And the point I'm trying to ask and get to is, how would that differ from virtually any service member's home in terms of the devices are in the phone, in the home, they're all Apple devices, therefore all of those devices, the government is going to say there was probable cause to search them?
I think, Your Honor, this court can acknowledge that device, that people change out the devices, technology gets sort of obsolete, they bring in, I shouldn't have said obsolete, but people change their devices, and this person obviously has changed out his devices over the past couple of years because these devices are all available. I understand that's maybe a little broader than this court would want to go, but I think it's warranted in this case where they are, there's no reason to not acknowledge what's sort of like the sky is blue at this point, which is there's an iCloud.
Well, counsel, when you're saying the sky is blue, then why didn't the law enforcement officers realize that the sky was blue? Why did he say, I don't have probable cause? Isn't it a little flippant to say the sky is blue?
I think law enforcement gets a lot of discretion here. There's another well-established doctrine that he could have taken these devices, right? They're presented to him. She's not a government agent at the time, but he doesn't talk about that. The first officer who testifies maybe is not.
Doesn't that sound
cautious.
Like it's a lack of preparation by the trial counsel, perhaps, if your argument is valid? And we're not looking at trying to save the government's case when it comes to probable cause determination. It's our responsibility to look at the record as it was developed below. If the government failed to develop the record, that's what we're dealing with.
Yes, Your Honor, and that they failed to develop some of this record because some of the issue was waived. This issue was raised below, that there was whether there was consent or apparent consent.
Well, counsel, let's, Chief, are you done? I want to wind back a little bit because you touched on it. Both parties have conceded that it was a non-government actor. If that is the case, then does Fourth Amendment analysis apply?
No, Your Honor. So that would be it would apply for the search. It does not apply
but not for the seizure.
For the seizure.
So if that is true, then do we need to get into the discussion of whether there was probable cause for the seizure?
No, Your Honor. And that's different. That's a problem with this record and a confusion I'm probably dealing with here is each, you know, there's the search versus the seizure doctrine. Mm-hmm. There's different reasons they accepted each of these devices. For the iPhone 10, that was certainly waived. But even so, there was the contraband evidence made plain on the device. Asinor says, hey, you know, no one is arguing that the government can't retain that for a while.
Okay, thank you. It was because we were so deep into the probable cause, and I just wanted to clarify whether government was stepping back from their concession that she was a non-government actor. Okay.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you. Moving on to that gave consent, which would eliminate the need for probable cause here. This rests on societal expectations. And I think something that we didn't argue strongly below, but is important here, is that these were married couple. This was a married couple. They'd lived in the home for 3 years, 4 years. They had been married for 4 years. In Klo, which is a 1988 case from this court, it says, in the absence of a clear showing one spouse has exclusive use of some area within the marital residence, the spouse's access to marital residence should be treated as access to all parts and to contents of any furniture or containers located there. So this is different, a distinction from a lot of the cases that the lower court discussed in their opinion. They're married here. That makes it a different case, and it's just for the seizure, not for the search, that we're relying on the apparent consent. And then in Weston, too, this was a case from this court, more recent. It's a consent case, married, and the non-present accused expressly refused consent before the agents went and asked his wife, who consented. And this court said that was okay. There's also distinctions between whether someone's married and whether it's a more casual, you know, roommate relationship, doesn't have the sort of imprimatur of a special relationship that a marriage is, that an officer should be able to rely on, at least for the seizure. And then distinctions between consent to seize and the consent to search. So in Clutter, which is the Eighth Circuit case, the father consented to the seizure of the son's computer. And there was no evidence that the father used or had electronic access to the computers, but the court still said that was okay. And same with Thomas in the 11th Circuit. They gave consent to search while the husband was home sleeping. In that one, they assessed whether the computer was easily accessible and located in an unlocked room. But again, that was for the search of the computer via consent. there's no unreasonable delay here where there's consent or apparent consent and no request from the appellee for the devices. He didn't assert his possessory interest during this case.
So is the government's position if the owner of the devices doesn't object or ask for them back, the government can keep them forever?
Not forever, Your Honor, but certainly for 3 months. The non-government agent part and the consent affect the reasonableness analysis for the government. So certainly not with just a probable cause, certainly not with just reasonable suspicion. That's, you know, hours. Probable cause probably gets you to a week. But certainly when you have consent, or the fact that they weren't They were taken from someone who is not a government agent. Those...
Well, let's just assume they're seized properly, but then the owner of the devices asks for them back in some reasonable time frame, a week, 2 weeks, however many. But what is the burden on the government at that point?
To move with alacrity or to develop probable cause and get those devices, at least a warrant to seize those, search those devices.
But it's the government's position that unless there's some request, then at least a three-month delay is entirely reasonable.
Under the facts of this case, Your Honor, yes. And that's because they believed they had consent here. And unlike Weston, there was no one saying, you don't have consent. He said, you don't have consent to search, and that's why they went and developed the probable cause for the affidavit and eventually got the warrant. And there, it's important to keep in mind that the agents throughout this case have acted cautiously. The first agent didn't take all the devices. The NCIS agent, when she gets it, you know, had testified that she looked at all these devices and opened them before she brought them to NCIS. And the government could have done, you know, a search of those devices that way, but they didn't. When they brought her in to talk to her, they just wanted the probable cause for each device, and then they went and got a warrant. So deterrence, I think, would be very, it wouldn't do anything for this case. Wouldn't do anything for the justice system. There's no bright line rules here, so that's another, we're talking about the judgment of the agent here. And there's nothing from this court that says specifically what's reasonable. And again, there's those two separate lines of cases talking about, you know, when Fourth Amendment rights are implicated by a seizure. Again, as in Latin, this court's case, this precludes the, suppressing this precluded the charge of one entire witness, the second child who was videotaped. The evidence, much of the evidence going to the child pornography charge, and this was reliable cell phone evidence. I see my time is up, Your Honor.
Any further questions from the bench? Seeing none, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Lieutenant Belter.
Good morning, Chief Judge Olson, honorable judges of the court, and may it please the court. I'm Lieutenant Raymond Belter, and I, along with Lieutenant Colonel Matthew Neely, represent appellant / cross appellee in this case, Master at Arms Chief Petty Officer Jeremy Harbord, United States Navy. For no compelling reason, law enforcement waited 3 months to obtain a search authorization for Chief Harbord.
Counsel, before you go there, you didn't raise this at trial, so the military judge didn't take any evidence on whether there was a compelling reason or not. I mean, we didn't have any kind of factual findings on why there was the delay or whether it was reasonable or not because you didn't raise it.
Your Honor, Chief Harbord preserved this issue for appeal.
You preserved it by saying it was an unreasonable search and seizure, but you didn't raise the timing issue, and so we don't have any evidence as to whether the government has an excuse or not.
The record is fully developed, Your Honor, as to what the NCIS agents were doing. The case activity log is all in the record. Testimony about agents' investigative activity is in the record. In addition, the arguments raised by trial defense counsel still preserve this unreasonable seizure issue, specifically where the trial defense counsel in his motions said that the evidence must be suppressed because it resulted, quote, from the unreasonable and unlawful seizures and searches of the same devices in violation of the Fourth Amendment. He then argued that the police search of the iPhone XS was without consent or a warrant. He then argued that NCIS lacked authority to interfere with his possessory interests in the seized devices by moving them from state to military jurisdiction. And at the 39 Alpha hearing, trial defense counsel argued that it lacked any authority over the devices and that NCIS waited 45 days to develop probable cause to, quote, justify the seizure in this case, end quote. And so the legal theory preserved at trial was always an unreasonable seizure of these devices, and that's exactly what Chief Harbord is arguing today, is that this is an
But whether it was reasonable or unreasonable, what does that have to do with the delay?
Because the delay caused the seizures to be unreasonable. In addition to the other legal issues that we've briefed, Your Honor, the delay directly goes to the unreasonability of the seizures, and that's exactly the general legal argument that was raised at trial.
And how does that satisfy the particularity requirement?
The particularity requirement.
Right. The military rules of evidence require that this objection be made with particularity. So how does never mentioning the delay satisfy the and preserve the argument that the delay transferred what may or may not have been a legal seizure into an illegal search?
Your Honor, first, the trial defense counsel did highlight this delay to the military judge with respect to the 45 days that NCIS took to try to develop probable cause for the other electronics. That's Joint Appendix at 449 to 50. And further, this court has said in United States v. Blackburn that talismanic words are not necessary to preserve an issue, and as long as the issue is inherent to the defense's argument, which here it's inherent, the reasonability of these seizures is inherent to the defense's argument, and so this issue is preserved for that issue, in addition to the fact that the record has many facts already preserved for this court to review, including an entire timeline of NCIS investigative activity. Additionally, the military judge didn't opine really on other issues that were raised, such as the actual or apparent authority to consent to the seizure. On that issue, the military judge ruled that issue was moot and didn't develop that in his ruling either. Yet, the government agrees that issue is certainly preserved as well. And so this court can certainly look outside of the military judge's ruling and look to the facts in the record and the argument that was made to determine that this issue was, in fact, preserved on appeal because it's a species of the same legal theory, to quote the D.C. Circuit.
And what is your response to the government counsel's argument that until the owner of the seized devices raises the issue or asks for them back or somehow otherwise presents the issue, that there is no sort of sua sponte burden on the government to act with any alacrity, at least not – it wouldn't – at least 3 months was certainly reasonable.
The case law indicates, Your Honor, that a specific assertion or request for return of property is merely one fact to consider, and it's not dispositive. This is a balancing test. And the Second Circuit in Smith found that there was no request for the property back, yet they found that the unreasonable post-seizure delay was dispositive in that case and ruled in favor of the appellant in that case, despite a lack of assertion of his possessory interests. Here, Chief Harbaugh, on day zero, Your Honor, he asserted his possessory interests. He was trying to get his iPhone XS back that had been ripped from his hands, and then his wife locked him out of the house, and he couldn't retrieve that device or any of the other devices.
To be fair, that's from his wife, right? I mean, he's trying to get the device back from his wife, but once it's seized by the government, he never took any action. At least there's no evidence that he did in the record that he asked for the devices back, that he attempted to force the government to give his devices back.
But that's correct, Your Honor, that he didn't. The record does not indicate that he made a specific request to return that property, but when NCIS confronted him on day 13, asking, if read him his rights, He invoked his right to remain silent. He invoked his right to counsel. And then he invoked his right to not consent to the searches of those devices. As a non-lawyer in that situation, he invoked every right that he was advised that he could invoke in that moment. That's a constructive assertion of his rights and his interests in that property, that he clearly did not want to waive any rights whatsoever with regard to the investigation of these electronic devices. And so this court should find that's a constructive assertion of his rights, which again is not a dispositive factor. And this court should find that the 3-month delay really is the dispositive factor that weighs in favor of appellant.
And the Supreme Court has certainly given guidance. I think this court has said the same thing, that there's a very strong possessory interest in your cell phone, that you can't get through life without it. It's an essential part of modern existence. That might be true with respect to the iPhone XS. Is that also true with respect to the other devices, since they are not, or at least we don't believe, and there's nothing in the record to suggest, and certainly not the iPads, that those are his day-to-day cell phone use?
Yes, Your Honor. There's still a substantial possessory interest in all of those electronic devices, especially in light of the fact that his primary day-to-day cell phone was seized and taken from him on day zero. He was locked out of the house to retrieve any of his other electronic devices. And so if he wanted to use that iPhone 6, for example, as a backup device because his other primary phone had been seized, he's prevented from even doing that. All his electronic devices were excluded from his possession. So he had no other, if he wanted the functionality of any electronic device, he would have to go and purchase another one for at least several hundred dollars. And because of not only that and also the expense that it would cost to replace the other seized electronic devices, that's certainly a substantial possessory interest that the circuits have also found in home computers and hard drives. The Second Circuit, the Fourth Circuit, and the 11th Circuit have held that there was substantial possessory interest in the smart tablet, in a computer hard drive. And so we have the same situation here, Your Honor.
Counsel, may I ask you two more questions about the seizure? You say his constructive assertion, you say that his assertion of his right not to have devices seized was a constructive assertion that he wanted the devices back, or that he didn't want them to be seized. Is that a finding of fact? Can we make that on appeal? Your constructive assertion argument.
This court does not have fact-finding authority, Your Honor, but it is a fair inference from the record. I mean, the facts are in the record that he made these assertions when confronted by NCIS. So those facts are there. And then to rule that that's a constructive assertion, that would be a legal conclusion that this court could certainly come to, and it would be a fair conclusion to come to based on what's in the record, Your Honor.
Okay. Second question, which is the government argues that his wife, as a private actor, is not affected by the Fourth Amendment. So when she took the devices and gave them to the government, there's no seizure there at all. And it seems to be the government's position that until he asked for the devices, the government hasn't done anything. They've just received something from a private individual, and so there's no Fourth Amendment analysis. And in a situation like that, where the government hasn't actually taken the devices but has been given the devices, isn't it a request to have the devices necessary to sort of start the clock on reasonableness?
No, Your Honor. I'm not aware of any case law that makes such a requirement.
Well, is it a seizure at all if a private individual takes the devices and gives it to the government?
In a vacuum, it very well may be, Your Honor. But in this case, no, because while we concede that Ms. Harworth was not a government actor, there are exceptions to the government actor doctrine that this court articulated in United States v. Wicks. Specifically, this court noted that there are circumstances when the government, quote, goes too far, end quote. And that's exactly what we have here, where even if a private actor drops off this property that she says is not hers, it belongs to her husband and not her, and she hasn't asserted any joint interest or authority over those devices. And then the government holds those devices for 3 months, and they even take 45 days to develop probable cause. Under the facts and circumstances of this case, the government has gone too far into the seizure and also too far into the search as well, in terms of holding those electronic devices. The case law doesn't draw a clear line, but in this case, the government doesn't have the authority to just hold someone's property without any probable cause, without any knowledge of its investigatory value for such a long period of time, and for that entire delay, which is all at law enforcement's doing to be considered a private seizure, wouldn't make sense in that regard, because the government has gone too far.
Well, suppose I agree with the general principle that the government can't hold it for an unreasonable time. My question still begins is, when does the clock start if the accused doesn't ask for the property back?
The clock should start at the time that law enforcement actually takes custody of the property, Your Honor.
Even if they've been given, they haven't, in the traditional sense, they haven't seized the property, they have been given the property. Your analysis is the same in each instance?
Yes, Your Honor, that's correct. In this case, the clock should start when the property was seized by law enforcement, and certainly by day 13, when now Honolulu Police Department is just handing the property over to a different jurisdiction, NCIS, and now we have a transfer from one law enforcement agency to another law enforcement agency, didn't go to NCIS directly and drop them off with NCIS. She dropped them off in a completely different jurisdiction. And so that's also a distinguishing factor in this case that, to my knowledge, the case law doesn't contemplate. And so at a minimum, day 13 should be considered day zero in terms of NCIS's clock, if we're only going to look at their activities in isolation. But even still, we're talking about a near 2.5 month delay, which would be unreasonable under both the Second, Fourth, and Eleventh Circuits holdings that we've cited.
So, counsel, I just want to be clear. So your argument, your unreasonableness is still going to the duration, not to the initial seizure. Because if you concede that she was a non-government actor, then as I lost track, I think it was Judge Maggs noted, that the Fourth Amendment doesn't apply. So this argument is on your duration, the duration of the seizure.
Not exactly, Your Honor. So okay. We are arguing both, and because we know from the record that on day 13, when NCIS took custody of that property, they testified on the record that they didn't know what value that property had. They testified that they were contemplating whether these items should actually be returned. When NCIS testified that they had to go item by item with on day 45, in order to, quote, know why she had provided these devices to NCIS, end quote, and that's Joint Appendix at 363. And when asked, you didn't know if it was connected to the iCloud at some point in time, the answer was, I did not know. That's Joint Appendix at 396. So it's evident from the record that NCIS, until day 45, when they developed probable cause, they didn't know what was on these devices. They didn't know what value they had, and they waited from day 13 to day 45 to even figure that out. And so NCIS's seizure of this property certainly lacked probable cause. And then, in addition, they waited that long to develop probable cause, and then they waited another 2 months to actually go get the search authorization. That is just facially unreasonable, Your Honor.
But how is it facially unreasonable? Based on the record in front of us, well, the record really isn't developed. And when we're talking about reasonable versus unreasonable, it's not an objective metric. It's amorphous. To simply state that it's unreasonable on its face, what would this court point to say it is unreasonable on its face that there was 3 months total and 2 months, as you just carved out, to actually get the CAS? What do we point to there?
Because there was no compelling justification. In the case law that's been briefed to this court, the circuits are balancing the duration and was there a compelling justification from the government to justify that duration. And here, there's no compelling justification whatsoever. And so
is the burden on the government strictly to show there's no compelling justification, or is the burden on the accused to show that it was unreasonable?
Certainly at the trial level, Your Honor, the burden would be on the government. The burden is on the government to show the constitutionality of the search and seizure of the evidence at issue. And so it should be the government's burden to show that. If this court finds otherwise, appellant still prevails, or I should say appellant cross appellee still prevails on this, because we've highlighted to this court, as we did to the lower court, all of the steps that NCIS was taking during this time frame from May to August. And what the record shows is that they weren't doing anything past the end of June to go seek a search authorization.
Isn't this exactly why the rules require these issues to be raised at the time? Because now we're all guessing about why the delay might have happened. But if this issue had been raised, then it would have been litigated. There would have been some fact-finding. Isn't this a perfect example of why the rules say if you don't raise something with particularity at the time, then it's waived? Because we can't unravel it now looking back. There's been the suggestion that we might need a debate hearing. Like, why is any of this necessary? Isn't this exactly what the rules tell us that we shouldn't need to do, because if you don't waive it at the time, then it's waived?
Your Honor, this court has said in United States v. Blackburn that talismanic words aren't necessary, and that even a subtle theory that's inherent to the defense argument still preserves the issue on appeal. So,
but at what point did the accused put the government's feet to the fire and say, hey, you've had these for a month, 2 months, 3 months, this is completely unreasonable? And then the burden absolutely would have been on the government to turn around and say, no, this is why it's reasonable, and they would have had to convince the military judge. But we didn't do any of that. Now we're trying to unwind all that years later. Isn't that exactly what the military rules tell us not to do?
Not in this case, Your Honor, because not only did trial defense counsel make a talismanic assertion, I should say more than a talismanic assertion in the motion, that this is exactly why the unreasonableness of the seizures was exactly why they were moving to suppress this evidence, but the trial defense counsel highlighted in oral argument to the military judge about the fact that they waited 45 days to even develop probable cause, highlighting the fact that they didn't have probable cause when they actually seized these devices in violation of the Fourth Amendment. And there's lots of testimony on the record, lots of cross-examination by trial defense counsel pulling these facts and these details out. And there's ample evidence, ample facts in the record for the court to assess and rule on this issue. However, if this court finds that this issue was waived, it was ineffective assistance of counsel to not properly raise and preserve this issue, because this issue would have been meritorious in light of the 3 month delay. Especially,
counsel, on that point, wouldn't we have to have a factual finding again on that about whether counsel was deficient in not raising it in terms of, well, if they raised it, was there a reasonable chance it would have been successful? Because if it wasn't a reasonable chance it would have been successful, we can't say counsel was deficient. And yet we don't have anything in the record, again, to tell us whether it would have been successful. Or we don't have enough in the record to tell us whether it would have been successful.
I disagree, Your Honor. I think that there is enough in the record to demonstrate that this would have been successful in light of all the investigative activity, documents, reports, in addition to testimony that are all developed in the record. This court can see exactly the days that the property was seized. They know exactly the day when they confronted Chief Harbord. They know exactly the day that NCIS tried to develop probable cause on day 45. This court also knows from the record that at day 66, that 66 to 70, that the lead agent on this case went TDY for training, and that on day 73 to 77, the agent went on leave. And again, it wasn't until day 88 that the agent even began drafting the CAS. The court has all of these facts to assess what the agent was doing. This court knows from what's in the record that the agent was keeping in touch with trial counsel, keeping in touch with the SJA, but not going to seek a CAS until they started drafting it on day 88. And so this court can weigh the substantial possessory interest in those devices with the lack of compelling justification for this delay. That's all in the record. And so this motion would, or I should say, this legal theory would have been meritorious at the trial level.
Is it sufficient with an ineffective assistance of counsel claim to merely point to the fact that the motion would have been meritorious? Isn't there also a requirement that there then would be a reasonable probability that it would have affected the outcome of the court-martial?
That's precisely correct, Your Honor.
So I have a question that flows from that then. You've got the CCA agreeing with the defense, saying this evidence should not have come in. And then importantly, the CCA adjusts the convictions based on that. So in the posture before us, how is there a reasonable probability that the results would change in the IEC context in light of the actions by the CCA?
Yes, Your Honor. For the reason that the CCA was incorrect in its analysis, specifically, without this evidence, and right now I'm referring particularly to the iPhone XS, without that evidence on a charge of indecent recording, the government wouldn't have the recording, and they wouldn't be able to prove the date that they charge in the specification, which is very close to the 2018 to 2019 change in the law. That would be very material to the government's proof. That information comes exclusively from that phone. This was the very first thing that the trial counsel told the members in their opening statement. They described the date and time that the screenshot was taken by Chief Harbord on that phone. They were referring directly to the electronically stored information that's on that phone. That's not something the government can recreate from a different source if that evidence were suppressed.
I'm a little bit confused here. Now you're referring to the iPhone XS or XS. But that came in differently under the plain view doctrine. So I'm not sure what point you're making in terms of the government pinning everything on the iPhone XS.
I apologize, Your Honor. So if this court finds that this issue was waived, it was ineffective for trial defense counsel to not raise this issue of the fact that a seizure that's lawful in its inception can become unlawful due to an unreasonable post-seizure delay.
Just to be clear, are you arguing that applies both to the iPhone XS and the other devices, or just the other devices?
To both, Your Honor. We're applying it to both. And so
you don't think it makes a difference that the police had seen contraband, evidence of a crime on the iPhone XS, and that they hadn't seen anything? They had no idea what's on the other devices. You don't think that makes any difference?
It makes a difference, Your Honor, in terms of the probable cause analysis, because we've conceded that Honolulu Police Department had probable cause under plain view to initially seize that iPhone XS. But what the Supreme Court has said in Place, in Jacobson, and Segura is that even something that is entirely constitutional at first can become unconstitutional because of an unreasonable post-seizure delay in getting a warrant or a search authorization. That's been the Supreme Court's doctrine since the 1980s. And so if trial defense counsel had preserved that, this court finds waiver, that theory would have been meritorious, and that would have led to and should have led to suppression of all the electronic devices. Even if it was lawful in the beginning, it can still be unconstitutional.
And my understanding is, had that actually been litigated below, there would have been sort of a totality of the circumstances analysis for the government to explain the delay, and you know, there would have been a lot of factors involved. You don't think the factor that the iPhone XS, the police had already seen the images on that device, would have changed the calculus on whether that 3 months was reasonable or unreasonable between the iPhone XS and the other devices on which they'd seen nothing?
No, Your Honor. I don't think so, because that doctrine is about the delay. It's about the delay itself. It really focuses on...
But I thought your whole argument was that the delay was unreasonable, and that unreasonable delay transformed what may or may not have been an illegal seizure into an illegal search that happened far too long later.
The argument is that it was a lawful seizure at first. It became an unlawful seizure due to delay pursuant to that Supreme Court doctrine. And therefore, because it was an unreasonable seizure, any subsequent search is fruit of the poisonous tree. And that should have led to suppression at the trial level. And if that evidence was suppressed, even if the witnesses could testify that they saw this image on that iPhone, the government has to prove that the accused knowingly recorded that image, and merely seeing an image on a device can't prove that that person recorded it. We all know that you can receive something on your electronic device through a myriad of ways, sometimes even accidentally. The government relied heavily on this proof at trial.
I mean, you're talking about proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the offense, but this would have just been an issue of whether or not they could maintain possession of the iPhone XS, right? I mean, is your really argument that if they had gone before the military judge after 75 days and said, look, they've had the iPhone XS for a long time, they haven't gotten a search authorization for it yet, they're still holding it, they need to give it back, or they've held it too long, that the military judge would have been persuaded?
On a 3 month delay, I do think the military judge would have been persuaded, especially in light of the way that the Second, Fourth, and 11th circuits have applied this Supreme Court doctrine, where they held that a phone, a smart tablet, a computer hard drive, they all ruled that even 1 month was an unreasonable
delay. But even on a device where the police have already seen evidence of a crime.
Yes, Your Honor, because that legal doctrine, that specific Fourth Amendment doctrine, isn't predicated upon how or why necessarily that the seizure happened. It's predicated upon the delay, and that the delay can turn a lawful seizure into an unlawful seizure. And so that wouldn't matter, and a 3 month delay would have been persuasive to the military judge under the facts and circumstances of this case, in spite of multiple instances of delay here. And so the proof at trial would have been fundamentally different if that electronic device had been suppressed. In addition to the opening argument, in their closing and rebuttal arguments, the government relied on just the electronically stored information for – I'm sorry, Your Honor. I see that I'm out of time. May I briefly conclude?
Let me ask first whether there are other questions.
I have one more.
Please.
Is that all right? I think the government, when they were at the podium, mentioned that there's no bad behavior by law enforcement to deter. I think what they mean by that is if we excluded this evidence, there's no teaching moment. The law enforcement won't learn anything, just sort of why we exclude evidence. I suspect you might have a different view on that point. What is if we exclude the evidence here, what did the law enforcement agents do wrong? What action are we trying to correct?
Yes, Your Honor. This application of the exclusionary rule would have significant deterrent value because of the gross negligence in timely obtaining a search authorization that happened in this case. That would absolutely have a deterrent value across the military law enforcement enterprise that you know, this is longstanding Supreme Court doctrine that can't just be ignored, and that when you wait an unreasonable amount of time without compelling justification, that can become an unconstitutional seizure. That have broad implications across the law enforcement enterprise, Your Honor.
Any further questions? Seeing none, you may briefly conclude.
Thank you, Your Honor. For these reasons, this Court should affirm the lower court's set-aside and set aside the remaining finding. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Lieutenant Belter. Major Finn.
A few brief points. The government doesn't need probable cause when they're simply accepting some objects from someone who is not a government agent. So just to clarify that, and that affects the reasonableness of the delay in getting the search authorization because there is no possessory interest implicated by the government's action. Certainly when he never asked for these items back.
Counsel, what about Pelley's argument that he constructively asked for them back when he didn't consent to their being searched? What, isn't it the implication is he doesn't want you messing with his devices?
That would be more applicable to someone who probably wasn't a law enforcement agent himself. We have someone who is a master at arms here, so presumably he knows that he should she should specifically ask for these. And then, of course, they're protecting two totally separate interests, the possessory interest versus the privacy interest. So he's saying he doesn't want it searched. To talk about if we do go down this road of analyzing, you know, what the government's interests in the delay were versus the appellee's interests in the delay here, the iPhone 6 is broken. So presumably a very reduced interest in a possessory interest in this iPhone 6, which he closed in the car door and doesn't work anymore. The iPhone 10S or XS, as Your Honor was discussing earlier, it's got contraband on it. The D.C. Circuit in Asinor sort of answered that question with, of course, the government can retain items with contraband on it. So that those two things are very weak possessory interests. And then you get to the iPad 4. The iPad 4, by June 24th, when the NCIS agent brings in to develop more probable cause or tells them that she has seen that she's done her own search of the iPad 4, so she knows it connects via the iCloud, and she's downloaded videos, or she was able to pull down and view on the iPad 4 the child pornography that is some of the issue in this case, which is the videos of the daughter masturbating. So that's the iPad 4. By June 24th, they know that has contraband on it, or at least some concrete link to contraband. So very much a reduced possessory interest. From June 24th to the search authorization, that's a mere 45 days. And it's also important to keep in mind that there is 7 days of delay here from submitting it to the SJA's office and then getting the search authorization. So from the SJA's office reviewing the affidavit to when the search authorization, when the agent sits down with the commander, and actually authorizes the search, there's another 7 days. So we have, when we
I see your time has expired. Any questions from the bench? You may briefly conclude if you wish.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just the government requests that the findings and sentence be upheld, and alternatively that this be remanded for further fact-finding if this Court disregards the waiver.
Thank you, Major Finn. The case is now submitted. The Court thanks counsel for both sides, and the Court will still stand adjourned until 9:30 tomorrow morning.